You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Very happy to have you with us. And boy, there's a lot going on. A bunch of decisions came down from the Supreme Court. Let me just give you a tease. We'll talk about this a little later on, but just think about this. Arizona was basically arguing, or, you know, at least to their people, that we can execute somebody based on a witness swearing under oath that they saw a crime. But if you swear under oath that you're a citizen, that's not good enough for you to vote. Now, the Supreme Court didn't make their decision based on that argument, but they made a decision about that topic. We'll get to that. So there's that going on. Edward Snowden did a live chat this morning that was fascinating, in which I think he essentially quoted me, which was a little spooky. We'll get to that. And in fact, let's get to that right now. James Bamford is with us. He's the author of his most recent book, The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. And his last name is spelled B-A-M-F-O-R-D, James Bamford. His, I believe it was your first book was The Puzzle Palace?
That's right, Tom, yeah.
Yeah, that book was extraordinary. And then you wrote a later book in which there was a chapter about the USS Liberty, as I recall.
Yeah, that was a book called Body of Secrets. I had a thick chapter in there on the Liberty.
Yes, I read it. So
appreciate it.
I've been reading your stuff for years and years. I am so pleased to have you with us, James Bamford. And you can, of course, you know, all the usual suspects, any bookstore, Amazon.com, there's an author's page, Amazon.com/James-Bamford. I'm curious your thoughts on these revelations that are coming out from apparently attributed to Edward Snowden that there was the U.S. was spying, the U.S. and Britain were spying on Russia and as well as on South Africa and other allies during this G8 meeting. And you know, what's your response? What's your initial reaction to that?
Well, it's certainly not a surprise to me. They've been doing that for since long before the NSA was created. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, in I think it was in Body of Secrets, I wrote about how the there was a real great desire to have the United Nations set up shop in New York. One of the key reasons was make it a great deal easier to eavesdrop on all that international communication, diplomatic communications flowing in and out of New York than if it was in some other country in Europe or some other part of the world. So they've been doing spying on international meetings ever since then. As a matter of fact, you can go back to early 1920s and they were spying on other participants in the international disarmament meeting. So spying on international meetings is just par for the course for NSA since it's long before its beginning.
Isn't it reasonable to assume it's par for the course for the intelligence apparatus or agencies of any of the developed nations of the world?
Well, that's why they have intelligence services, to get intelligence on anything that might be useful to the government that the intelligence organization is working for. And if you're going into play cards with other members of the international community, it's much nicer if you have a little earpiece where somebody's telling you what the other people's cards are.
Yeah. To what extent is that legal or illegal?
Well, I mean, that's when you're dealing internationally or outside the United States, legality is not really a issue, since spying is technically illegal in any country as long as you're spying on that country and even to some degree spying on other countries in a foreign country. So, I mean, technically it's illegal, but You know, that's the nature of spying, the second oldest profession.
Yeah, I mean, spies are described in the Bible. King David sent out his spies. Jehoshaphat sent out spies.
They didn't have an NSA or electronic spying back in biblical days, but human spying, they certainly did.
Yeah, Jehoshaphat had two guys. Have you had an opportunity yet to read the transcript of Edward Snowden's live chat today with The Guardian?
I have it here, but I haven't had a chance to read it. I've just been really busy with other things.
I can imagine. There was one moment in there where, I've been saying on the air over and over and over again, more people die falling in bathtubs than are killed by terrorists in the United States. And if you aggregate 9/11 into a 10-year period, that's true of pretty much always. And we've been Googling it today. No one else seems to be saying that. And Edward Snowden today said, bathtub falls and police officers kill more Americans than terrorism, yet we've been asked to sacrifice our most sacred rights for fear of falling victim to it. He was asked at one point, what would you have to say? In fact, here's the exact question. What would you say to others who are in a position to leak classified information that it could improve public understanding of the intelligence apparatus of the USA and its effect on civil liberties? And his answer was, this country is worth dying for. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, you know, there's this divide in the country. Is he a traitor? Is he a whistleblower? And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that the whistleblowers are very heroic people. They sacrifice enormous amounts of, you know, the rest of their life, their careers or their financial independence, a lot of things. And so I just think that's it's a very patriotic thing to do, is to blow the whistle on something that you see is wrong. And Mr. Snowden is not the first person to come out and say these things. Bill Binney said them last year. The only problem was he didn't have any documents to back him up.
Mm.
And so it took, that's pretty much what it took to shed light on this, was extracting the documents. If he had walked out of NSA and gone to the press and said what he what were in the documents, the next day the NSA would have come out and just said the same thing they said last year. He's wrong. The same thing they said about Binney. We don't do that. We don't do surveillance on Americans and all that, and that would have been the end of it. But you can't do that if you produce the documents.
James Banford, what should Americans, we just have a minute left, what should Americans be doing right now in response to these revelations?
Well, they really need to, if they believe strongly enough, get in touch with their Congress people, write letters to the editor, protest if there's a protest going on or whatever. It shows the fact that this is important to them. That's the problem. The government thinks that the people don't show enough interest into this topic, so we'll keep it secret and just keep doing it. The British had the opposite point of view when I was over there. It was that they would take this same type of thing, whether you're going to do surveillance on people's internet communications or whatever, and put it through the legislature, or rather the parliament, and vote on it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. James Banford, author of his most recent book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. And James Banford, thanks again so much for being with us today.
I appreciate it, Tom. Good being on your show.
Great talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what should our response to Bamford be? And, you know, what did he say about being in China and Hong Kong? I'll tell you about that after the break. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is not just... boy, there is so much going on in the world. I mean, you know, it's not just the day that we're learning more and more about, you know, the G8 wiretapping and all this other stuff, But also, we're coming up on an anniversary for Watergate, if I recall correctly. John Dean, author and columnist at Justia.com and former Nixon White House counsel, is on the line with us, author of numerous books. By the way, for our Denver, Colorado listeners who are listening to Denver's Progressive Voice, our Clear Channel station there, John Dean will be presenting a Watergate-based continuing legal education program in Denver all day Friday, June 21st at the Four Seasons Hotel. You can get more information on that at CLE.com or WatergateCLE.com, and there'll be links to that over at TomHartmann.com. John Dean, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Watergate was the last major wiretapping scandal. Your thoughts on this one?
Well, they're very different. We're at different times. It's quite Nixon was conspicuously illegal in the sense that he sought no warrants, had no statutory approval. In fact, he would pull his wiretaps on news people when the Supreme Court ruled that they would not authorize warrantless wiretapping. We're in an era now where there is some color of authority for a president and his National Security Agency to be doing what they're doing, which is the Patriot Act, which has still been renewed and renewed, and the current provisions still have a ways to go to get into the sunset. So who knows how people will react. But we're having a good debate on it, at least now, something that didn't occur when the law passed.
Yeah. What are your, you know, as a lawyer, as a former, you know, senior person in the executive branch of government, as in my opinion, just, you know, one of the most brilliant observers of government in the United States, I'm curious your take on where we're at in this Ben Franklin debate, you know, this privacy versus security, and where we should go.
Well, I think the first prerequisite has finally been arrived at. I don't know that, you know, leaking documents is always the best way to raise a debate, but Snowden certainly has done that. And that is to address what the law is or should be, and that's sort of the underlying situation. Now, have we gone too far? Well, technology changes, and what's interesting is, Tom, a lot of people who feel that they're doing nothing wrong don't mind somebody snooping as to what they're doing, and that's understandable. You know, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why do I have to be concerned? I'd like that little extra bit of security if it's going to result in terrorism being less likely to happen. But what happens is we just keep chipping away a little by little at our rights until finally you wake up one day and there are none. And it's the slippery slope argument. And how far down have we gone? I don't think very far yet. I'm certainly not in the school of a Dick Cheney who told Fox News over the weekend, well, don't worry, governments do everything right. That has not exactly been proven to be true. But on the other hand, I certainly don't, you know, I don't think any people have anything to fear at this point. I'm actually more concerned by private corporations and what they're doing with this information and the amount that they're collecting, unbeknownst to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say to my friends that when you get a free service or a free application or what have you, when you get that, you are the product of that company.
Mm-hmm.
And you should understand that it is really not free.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people were shocked when they discovered that Google actually reads their Gmails.
Right.
You know, they do it with robots looking for keywords so that they can figure out what ads to send to you. But, hey, they're reading your email. Well, surprise, it was free.
I was looking for an interesting tool the other day online, a screw extractor.
Mm-hmm.
That's something everybody uses every day. I had a stripped Phillips screw, and as a result of my search, I'm bombarded now with screw extractor ads.
Really?
So it does work that way.
Boy, that's pretty damn granular. I mean,
yeah, it is.
That's amazing. I Mark Felt, I believe his name was, who ultimately we found out was Deep Throat.
Yes.
How is he different than Ed Snowden or vice versa?
Well, Snowden has been fairly open, and he's obviously made himself conspicuous. You know, Snowden is more parallel with a Dan Ellsberg than with a Mark Felt, who almost to the bitter end of his life denied that he was a leaker.
Right. But had Felt been outed, I mean, arguably by revealing what he did, wasn't he revealing national intelligence secrets, in quotes, to Woodward and Bernstein the same way that, assuming that what Snowden has put out is, as he says, nothing that is actionable or illegal or harmful to the United States?
You know, Felt wasn't really operating in the national security area with Watergate. So there is a distinction. Also, Tom, I think there's a distinction that's made between the leaker and the whistleblower.
Right.
The whistleblower is very open that he's blowing the whistle because he feels activities have gone beyond what they should be. He or she has decided there's no internal way to stop it. So they use the disclosure of information to reveal it, and the misconduct that they perceive. The leaker, typically you don't know who that person is or what their motive is. Now, what's interesting about Felt's motive, there's a wonderful book done by Max Holland on Felt and his motive, which was to get a job as the head of the director of the FBI.
Oh, amazing, amazing. John Dean, if you are in Denver and you want to learn from John Dean, particularly if you're looking for CLE credits, check out CLE.com, WatergateCLE.com. John Dean, thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can find all of John Dean's books at all the usual sources. And my favorite is Conservatives Without a Conscience, but he's written many. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Wow, a lot going on. The G20 is getting underway. The G8 is underway today, and President Obama gave a speech to the young people of Northern Ireland, which was very, very well received. And tonight, it may be happening right now, because right now is tonight in Europe. He's having dinner with Vladimir Putin. That should be interesting, given that we just discovered that the U.S. was spying on Russia during the last meeting between Obama and Putin.
Yes.
As James Bamford said, I mean, you know, kind of everybody does it, but not everybody talks about it. It's like, anyway. There's this battle going on over Syria. Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is openly criticizing, to quote Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, openly criticizing the Russian support for Syria. I think that, and of course the Iranians have announced, well not, and of course, apparently it has come out that Iran was planning or is planning or maybe already is sending 5,000 of their people into Syria to help the Assad government. So it's looking like this could be really, really sketchy. This could be a very dangerous situation. This is not like, going into Zimbabwe, where pretty much everybody agrees that Robert Mugabe is nuts, and saying, you know, we're going to take out the government and help replace it with a better government. And this gets back to my argument that, which I made last week and at some length, and I will make again in more brief form, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. And that is that revolutions that don't happen from within, from the bottom up, are revolutions that are doomed, that are just, you know, unnecessary shedding of blood, that when And the reason why is because if there is enough popular support to pull off a successful revolution, then there's enough popular support to form a successful form of government. If there's not enough popular support to pull off a successful revolution, then after the revolution, you're going to be right back. You're not going to be right back where you started. You're going to be in a worse position. You're going to have an incredibly unstable situation, and it's going to be an absolute mess unless you're going to engage in nation building, unless you're going to do what we did in the Philippines and in Puerto Rico, you know, station military there and fight insurgents for five generations, as we're doing to this day in the Philippines. And we started that war in 1898, the Spanish-American War. So tread carefully. George Washington warned us about this. He said, basically, outside of commerce, don't get involved in the politics of other countries. And, you know, I'm with him on that. And, in fact, here's what Mr. Putin had to say about Mr. Obama's decision to arm the Syrian rebels. He said, one does not really need to support the people who not only kill their enemies, but open up their bodies, eat their intestines in front of the public and cameras. Yeah, great, Victoria notes, you know, great start. Great way to, you know, start a conversation with Obama in which he's supporting these rebels who, well, they're a mixed bag. I mean, there's no doubt many, many good people among the rebels and no doubt many, many bad people among the rebels. It's kind of the nature of some rebellions, but particularly of one like this. People like to, in their minds, draw parallels to the American Revolution. But there's a couple of things to remember about the American Revolution that are quite important. The first is that we were a fairly well-developed country, given the era. The second is that, and this is probably the most important, is that we had all the institutions for our own governance established and running. We basically had a shadow government here. Every state had a legislature. Every state had a governor. Counties had county officials. Cities had city officials. There were elections in some cases for these people. Although most of them were appointed by the crown, they were there. And so making the transition from having, you know, a legislature and a governor appointed by the crown to one elected by the people was not that dramatic a transition. We had small d democratic institutions or small r republican institutions in place, number one. Number two, we had popular support. We didn't have to have, you know, Canada come help us or Mexico come help us or Spain come help us or France come help us. France did loan us money, but, hey, they were just playing banker. Now you can say, well, you know, they wanted to put their thumb in the eye of the British. Sure. But they were just putting money at risk. It's a very, very different thing. So I don't think that, I think that when we think of these guys as if they were American revolutionaries, we make a terrible mistake. Just saying, tread very, very carefully. Britain, it turns out, was spying on the G20 delegates, as was the United States. This has just come out. Latest on the NSA leaks. I mentioned Snowden, his bathtub quote. And I just want to say, you know, Ed, if you're listening to the show, we'd love to have you on as a guest. Just our contact information is on our website at tomhartman.com. But, you know, that said, he's right. More people die slipping in bathtubs in the United States than are killed by terrorists. Why the national hysteria? Why the hundreds of billions of dollars to private for-profit corporations, you know, aka contractors? Why an enormous spy facility? Is this... I think my question answers itself. With regard to the immigration bill, this is another one that's really interesting to watch. As the Republicans, you know, you've got Marco Rubio out here now saying, you know, who was one of the one of the gang that authored the original bill, saying, hey, you know, you put gay people in there, and I'm not going to vote for that thing. And I'm still not sure I'm going to, and, you know, it's, and there's all these poison pill amendments, and, you know, the Republicans are just like all wringing their hands. And then at the same time, you have Republicans saying, well, you know, or Lindsey Graham, I guess, over the weekend saying, you know, that if Republicans can't figure out how to get Hispanics to vote for them, they're toast in the 2016 election. Because it's an expanding part of the American electorate. And I think even if they pass this immigration bill, it's not going to work to the benefit of the Republicans the way that they think it will. Because it's so draconian. It is so difficult. There are so many hoops. There's so much stuff to jump through. There, you know, it's just. So we'll see how this shakes out. The IRS, another week, another leak. Darrell Issa has leaked another little bit of testimony. A woman in Washington, D.C., working for the IRS, said, yeah, she reviewed some of these applications. She also, though, said that Tea Party, they weren't specifically looking for groups that called themselves Tea Party, but within the IRS, they used the phrase Tea Party to generically refer to any group that was political. Oh. In other words, it's looking less and less like a conspiracy and more like just, you know, bureaucrats doing their job and not, you know, it's like the East Anglia emails, right, where the scientists were having a spitting war with each other about some little nuanced part of a piece of a scientific paper. And so when it was selectively leaked by climate change deniers, you know, groups funded by the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil, it made it look like there was actually some kind of dispute going on at East Anglia University. There wasn't. But it looked bad to them, you know, looked bad on them. And you know, similarly, this is going to look bad to and on the people at the IRS, like, you know, they weren't considering the fact that their conversations might become public. So the states all across the United States are developing photo ID databases. And this is downright spooky stuff because they're being now assembled into national facial recognition databases and not just used to compare mugshots to mugshots, but used to compare things like, you know, camera traffic cameras and crowd shots at like protests or demonstrations. It's like we're getting closer and closer to 1984 every single day. So we'll see where all this stuff goes. We'll pick up your phone calls after the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Ed Snowden, by the way, I thought this was just a brilliant thing. When somebody asked him, what would you say to somebody, you know, a future whistleblower, somebody who sees something wrong and thinks about speaking out at great risk to themselves, his response was, this country is worth dying for.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I agree with him. This country is worth dying for. It's an extraordinary state. Seven minutes before the hour, welcome back. John Hartman here. We'll be defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Joe in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, I never thought I'd say this, but I was listening to Glenn Beck today, and he made a good point with the immigration bill.
Okay.
And he said that by passing the immigration bill, you're going to pretty much inject more cheap labor into an already cheap labor market and just pretty much hurt more poor people.
No, he's wrong.
I think, yeah, good point.
No, he's wrong. He's wrong. What is happening right now, and this is the reason why basically you find so much right-wing opposition to the immigration bill. What's happening right now is you've got 11 million people in this country who are working illegally, and their employers know it, and their employers know that the odds of the employers ever going to jail are pretty close to zero. Because ever since Reagan did his amnesty thing in 86, he stopped enforcing laws against illegal employers. He, you know, and basically only enforced laws against illegal employees. So you've got people who are working for people who basically can treat them like you know, dog dirt. I mean, they can treat them terribly. They can abuse them. They can threaten them. They can exploit them. They can refuse to give them paychecks, and regularly do, by the way. And those practices are driving down the labor market hugely. If you make those people legal citizens, so that now their work is in the light, and their employers have to declare their work, and they have to pay at least a minimum wage, and they're subject to fair labor practices laws, what you are going to see is that the general cost of labor in the United States is going to rise, because there's basically no longer a slave class available. Right now, the illegal class is the slave class, as it were, and it's driving down the cost of labor. So Beck's logic is absolutely upside down. He's completely wrong. By passing immigration reform and bringing people out of the shadows, and then on the top of that, enforcing laws against illegal employers, what you are going to do is strengthen the labor market in the United States. Now, if you threw open the doors to the, as part of immigration reform and said, hey, by the way, we'll accept another 10 million people over the course of the next 12 months. Yes, that would suppress wages. But that's not even remotely what they're talking about. There's no discussion about anything like that. Well, all we're talking about is taking people who are already here, already working, and already making probably $4 and $5 an hour because they're working under the table for cash, and moving them into the real economy where they have to be paid at least $7.25 an hour. So wages are going to go up. This is, you know, beware of what you hear from right-wingers, particularly the corporate right-wingers, because typically what they're doing is they're putting out, you know, the big corporate propaganda. Those meatpacking companies, they want to continue to have basically slave labor to exploit. The construction companies, they want to continue to have slave labor to exploit. The industries that use, quote, illegal labor, quote, actually, they're quite happy with this, with the situation the way it is today, and they're not pushing for immigration reform. The only industry that I know of that's actually pushing for immigration reform is the tech industry, and that's because they want more H-1B visas, and they've got their own little, which I oppose, but they've got their own little thing slipped in there, and they're not, you know, they don't care at all about, you know, the labor at the level of a maid. Evan, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you're telling me that I was wrong about the French and the American Revolution?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I listen to you all the time, and I usually agree with pretty much everything you say.
What did I miss?
I actually agree with your point about revolutions, but they really need to come from within. You know, like when people love to ask that question, oh, you want Saddam Hussein back in power? It's like, no, I hope his people would have overthrown him by now.
Right.
But What the French did, not only did they give us money, they gave us weapons and gunpowder, and we only won the battle that won the war because the French Navy was blocking the British escape. They sent soldiers, they sent the Navy, and in fact, they spent so much money that they bankrupted their own country, and that's what led to the French Revolution.
I've heard that posited as one theory for the French Revolution.
It's a
subject of hot dispute.
They were involved in a lot more than, but there is no dispute that they were involved in a lot more than just.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for correcting me, Evan.
Their Navy. But the point is true that you need the, you know, we wanted to rise up, and that's what was important. So we could be the economic engine or even the arsenal engine of peoples who want to rise up, like in Syria, but we shouldn't send troops or anything, but we can, you know, we can still be there.
Yeah.
And help them if they want to rise up, which it seems like they do.
Yeah, well, and that leads to another point. And Evan, thank you for the call. And assuming that you're correct, and I'm not a naval history battle war guy, in all probability you are. I stand corrected. Rick has a point in Western West Virginia. Has a point that he wants to make about Syria is to Russia as Israel is to America. You're saying?
Yes, it's definitely true. I mean, we sell a lot of weapons to Israel. They get they have a big lobby. Syria is the biggest arms buyer from Russia, and China's in there a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We ain't got no business being over there.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't hear people crying the blues when Iran and Iraq was at war in the 80s and Saddam Hussein gassed the other side with chemicals that we sold them, and the French and the British and probably Germany.
Yeah, Don Rumsfeld sold them the...
yeah, well, see, a lot of people ain't got it. You know, as Americans, we have a short memory.
Right.
But no, it was sold as fertilizer, wink, wink.
Right.
We didn't do nothing about it. What, they eat 40, 50,000 people? Look,
well, killed by the gas, over a million people were killed in that war between Iraq and Iran. On each
well,
side.
Whatever, you know.
Yeah. So you're right. And we just.
I feel for them people, but we have no business over there. I've missed out on 10, 12 years of my kids' lives because they, 9/11 and everything.
Mm.
We are overextended. The American people are tired of it. And I voted for Obama. And I don't like him countdown to the military industrial complex because the only way they can make money is to have wars continuously so they can sell more weapons.
Yeah, there you go. You said it, Rick. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, I talked last week. Welcome back, by the way. I talked last week about how I think one of the most pernicious, corrosive, cancerous, destructive, dangerous things that a person can say about the, not necessarily the NSA program, any spying program, is, in an open society anyway, is, well, I live an exemplary life. I have nothing to fear. And so bring it on. I don't care. And there's a surprising number of people who put that argument out. And you know, maybe they do live exemplary lives, and maybe it is totally boring, and they really do have nothing to fear. But should the day ever come, A, that they want to engage in political activism, they have pretty much cut off their ability to do so, if there is anything that could even be taken out of context and used against them. And B, what they have done is they have allowed all the imperfect people out there who may want to involve themselves in political activities, like somebody who wants to be president of the United States and yet has fathered several babies with his slave, like Thomas Jefferson. They cut off the possibility of any of those people ever participating in public office if the government says, has the power to just call them up one day and say, hey, here's what we know about you. So anyhow, that was my take on it. Jamie Weinstein has been cogitating on this. He's a senior editor over at the Daily Caller, the conservative website, dailycaller.com, and co-author of a hilarious and thought-provoking book, The Lizard King. And Jamie, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
So you heard my riff. I'm curious your take on this.
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily quick to condemn it. I do have some troubles with it. I'm a national
it being
security,
what?
I'm a national security hawk, so I understand that sometimes I think a very serious threat to our country is Islamist terrorism. Sometimes you might have to give up some security in order to prevent what is the grandest threat to us, which is terrorists armed with weapons of mass destruction that would hit us at home. That really is what we're preventing.
Why is that the grandest threat to us when there are, you know, there are viruses mutating that could kill millions of us? There's tens of thousands of us who die every year from preventable diseases because we have a dysfunctional healthcare system. I mean, more people, as Edward Snowden pointed out this morning, and as I've been pointing out for a long, long time, more people die slipping in bathtubs every year than have been killed by terrorists in the history of the United States.
I'd like to go on, but I'll address that quickly. I think it's a specious argument because it's not that more people die as of terrorism as of now. You're correct. More people die of drowning in pools right now than they do have died on American soil of terrorism last year and the year before and the year before that. Which the threat of but the threat still exists of terrorists with weapons of mass destruction that could kill tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even over a million people if it was successful. So the threat exists there. A million people aren't going to die of drowning in a bathtub. In a single year.
So, you know, we should do something about that threat, but does that mean that we should be giving up our liberties for that security? I mean, you realize what Ben Franklin had to say about your argument.
I've been to enough liberal rallies to see that quote. I do think it's truncated, though. But my concern is one of two things. One is, are we actually stopping threats with this? Have we foiled terrorist plots? And the two examples that have been given so far haven't convinced me that's the case. And maybe there are more and they can't say them. But what they've given us so far is the Zazi case of the subway attack in New York, which right. is not clear that was actually foiled because of these surveillance programs.
Correct.
And number two is the David Headley attack, which he helped plan and plot, the Mumbai attack in India. But they only caught him after the attack had already taken place. So that is not, you know, very illustrative of a great success of this program in stopping a terrorist attack.
Right.
And number two is, are these being used beyond what we would maybe grant, what Americans might be okay with granting some power to in order to stop extraordinary attacks? Are they being used to spy on Americans, ordinary Americans? And as you know, in 2008, there was those revelations from some whistleblowers allegedly that they and other analysts at the NSA were spying on Americans calling home from the Green Zone in Iraq and others, not because they were threats because of terrorism, but just listening into them having calls with their wives and whatever they right. might have been talking there.
Sex talk in particular, especially Skype, you know, wives flashing breasts and things, and these guys were making CDs of this and passing this around to each other.
And that is alarming, as is even the prosecution of Elliot Spitzer, who wasn't necessarily only caught because of Patriot Act programs, but because of because one of the programs in the Patriot Act, he was targeted because of scrutiny that was going on in the banking. You know,
well, and he was caught. I don't know if you've seen the movie Client Number 9, but he was caught because a federal felony was committed by Roger Stone, the Republican consultant who had been hired by a billionaire that Spitzer had really PO'd.
He may not have anything to do with it, but he was ensnared partly due to scrutiny that was given to his banking accounts as a result of a provision in the Patriot Act.
Right.
And when, you know, Americans supported the Patriot Act, you probably didn't support it, Tom, but when most Americans, I think, supported the Patriot Act, they supported it because they thought it was going to go after terrorism, not after Elliot Spitzer.
Right. Not after
so
guys who patronize.
I have those concerns and those two questions that at least have to be met before I would like to contemplate a program like this. And so far, I'm still questioning it. And, you know, I still could be persuaded that you know, it is a proper program. But I'd like to see the president and others make the case. What I don't think is Mr. Snowden is some hero. I think what he's doing right now is proving that he's anything but with revealing things that the NSA is supposed to do, like target Dmitry Medvedev in Russia and enemies and potential you know, people that might have you know, enemies in the United States.
Yeah, well, I think in this case he's revealing stuff that is, you know, falls into the category of duh. But that said, the entire concept that we should actually let me reboot this thought. We have now tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are working. In fact, I think the total number is 480,000, over 480,000 people working in the private sector in this whole national security machine. This is just short of a half million people. And they don't have the whistleblower protections that federal employees have. They don't have the oversight that federal employees have. Their actions cannot be the subject of a congressional subpoena, or they can with some difficulty, but they certainly can't be the subject of a Freedom of Information Act request by the Daily Caller, by a journalist like yourself. Isn't that troubling?
Well, actually, I would have a different angle on why it's troubling. not necessarily the private versus government angle, but the fact that a low-level employee, someone who's not necessarily senior, like it sounds Eric Snowden wasn't the most senior person in the world, is able to get access to such classified records, or even people like Bradley Manning were able to get access to such classified records. How is our security when people this low in the chain are able to access it? That is my concern, whether they're private or government workers, but people that shouldn't have necessarily the access that they're getting. That's a concern of mine.
Yeah. It seems that the conservative argument would be, let's tighten this up, let's have more oversight. It just, you know, it seems to me that would have been Barry Goldwater's take.
I think there's two wings to conservatives.
Yeah, Jamie, we've run out of time, and because we're bringing your audio in by Skype, once the music starts, it kills it. I'm sorry. But we'll continue this conversation another time. Jamie Weinstein, senior editor over at the Daily Caller, dailycaller.com, co-author of The Lizard King. Jamie, thank you for being with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in just a moment, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Jeffrey in Somerset, Kentucky. Hey, Jeffrey, what's on your mind today?
First time, I just wanted to address some of these NSA issues, and there's one point that I haven't heard brought up on any of the commentary about this concerning some senators and congressmen that know about this and some that don't. Mm-hmm. My mother used to work for the NSA for over 25 years, and she's retired now. Mm-hmm. And there are certain levels of security clearance for every position in the government, and of course, including the president and vice president.
Right.
And there are some senators and congressmen that don't have a security clearance to view this stuff.
Yeah.
It's quite simply put, they do not have that security level. And kind of goes back to the old the president's birth certificate. Okay, the president could not run for president or even be on the ballot if he did not pass the security clearance check and reach the proper level of security clearance to be the president of the United States.
Right.
Okay. And so that debunks that theory right away. And there are some speculators out there. That's why Donald Trump did not run, because he could not get the proper security clearance to be president of the United States. Who knows what he's got, what kind of skeletons he has in his closet.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially a Vegas casino owner who's been through bankruptcies and heaven only knows what all. So, yeah, I understand. And there are, and thank you, Jeffrey, for the call. And there are people who have worked for the NSA as contractors who have no security clearance as well. I mean, you know, and I'm one of them. Back in the 1990s, I owned an ad agency, Chandler McDonald Stout, Schneiderman and Poe, Inc., DBA, the Newsletter Factory. And we were hired by the NSA to do a couple of days worth. It was just a short couple of days worth of work. And I was the guy who did it. And then 4 or 5 years later, they hired me again for a couple of days, about 2 days' work. And this was, you know, consulting work on communications. It's what I do, or what I used to do, you know, teach people how to write and speak and stuff like that. And so I guess in a very tactical sense, or actually in an absolute legal sense, I was a contractor to the NSA, and my company was. And, you know, I'm assuming that they vetted me somehow, but I, to the best of my knowledge, I don't have a security clearance. On the other hand, you know, the stuff that I was doing was, you know, didn't involve state secrets. So I can't talk about what it did involve, but didn't involve state secrets for sure. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about, actually, I think a big issue with this national security is money. And locally, I once went to a meeting just really kind of accidentally. I didn't really know what it was about, but it was called the National Security Forum, and it was put on by a law school here, the William Mitchell College of Law, and there were several institutions that were interested in how they were going to spend this money and all the opportunities that this money was going to provide for them. And then they also had some journalists for balance who said very little, if anything, about what, you know, their, what is actually going to happen to our civil liberties and whatnot. They were pretty quiet. And there was also an ex-FISA court judge that is now a Supreme Court judge here in Minnesota, and he had the most to say, and I could see that he felt quite, you know, guilty about what was going on and didn't really know how to approach this whole issue. Yes, you know, there is the possibility that we may be bombed, we may have this happen, and we may have that happen, but how do we really assess what it is that these people are doing? And as I, you know, called in last week, I had said that after the Patriot Act went through, the FBI was at people's door right here in this city, you know, because they happened to talk to, you know, so-and-so who talked to so-and-so. And, you know, there's a lot of humanitarian groups in this city that were involved in areas like Nicaragua, Guatemala, in Peru, and whatnot. And these people are in the estimation of the FBI, terrorists, because they're giving, quote, material assistance to terrorists because they've talked to them. But actually, I was just shocked at this meeting. It was creepy and it was bizarre, and I'll tell you why. The venue of it was interesting in and of itself. They had the meeting at the Mall of America, and they have a place there where they can conduct meetings down from the huge amusement park that they have in the center of Mall of America. And, you know, I sat through that meeting, and by the time I got out of there, I mean, I guess I'm very idealistic, very naive. I had a headache because, you know, I thought when people went to law school, they wanted to learn at least about the law before they abused the law. And that's what I felt was going on there. The journalists, I felt, had no spine whatever and should have been, you know, hot, you know, just saying a lot more instead.
So this was basically a forum on how to make a quick buck off government contracts?
There was a person who handed me a card because he was involved in stopping chemical, you know, terrorism. There was the University of Minnesota. There was a group from there that were involved in stopping bioterrorism. They had a speaker. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't in the, it was, the venue was just bizarre. And what the absolute coup de, you know, the grand, you know, the end of this whole afternoon that I spent, which I could have spent in my garden instead, I went to this meeting to see what this was about, was I was driving down Ford Parkway in St. Paul past the Ford plant, which is shuttered, and a crazed driver just about killed me. And I just thought, you know, the symbolism of, you know, like, for instance, George Bush said, go after 9/11, go shopping. Mm. And then, you know, this person, I mean, that's my real threat in my everyday life. And yes, perhaps they're preventing these terroristic threats. But as far as I've seen so far, how has it been used? It's been used against our own people.
Well, I'm not sure that it's been used against us, but the potential for it to be used against us is certainly there, and that's bad enough. John, thank you for the call. We'll do that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Isn't it funny that conservatives who yell about, you know, big government's a bad thing, want government to hire more contractors and grow? Back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, not a chance. Don't get that idea out of here. And yeah. Welcome back, Paul in Perry, Oklahoma. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine.
You know, I haven't watched you in a couple of weeks, and I come turn on TV and your arm's in a sling.
Yeah, I've got a thing in my shoulder, a half torn rotator cuff thing that if I keep it from tearing all the way, then it'll heal up and I'll be fine. And if I screw up, then I end up having surgery. So that's why it's in a sling.
Your television show, literally at the Rumble You weren't rumbling with one of your guests, were you?
No, it's I think it's partly from typing too much. I think that inflamed the whole thing, and then we had this brilliant idea to join a gym, which turns out not to have been such a great idea.
Well, I hope it clears up.
There's a cautionary tale in there, Paul. Anyhow, what's up?
I came across this interesting book. It was published in 1935. I'm not sure you may have heard of it, by Hermann Levy. It was called Industrial Germany.
I'm not
familiar. The sociologist was interested in how Germany came out of the Depression the way it did. And he came to some interesting conclusions of what he called, was based on IG Farben, of course. What you call international corporations, he just simply called it cartels.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about it is it was the force of this that was designed by certain leaders of the Nazi Party to reindustrialize Germany by having these cartels pretty much run the show. He points out that the whole point was the integration and the monopolization of these industries into a single unit.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, one of Hitler's great achievements. I mean, he was following Mussolini's model and incorporating German industry into the German state. That's the definition of fascism, is the merger of corporate and state interests.
Well, it's interesting, this was pointed out in 1935, and it's so relevant today.
Yeah.
These so-called unregulated market capitalists are not unregulated at all. It's just the opposite. They're very regulated. They're regulated in their favor.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the integration, it involves the military, of course, and the social structures. I remind you, this is published in 1935. He's talking about gated communities in this book of workers.
Amazing.
I don't know if you ran across this in your research.
No.
But I think it's worth looking at.
I mean, the title is, again?
Industrial Germany, and it's published in 1935 by Hermann Levy.
Okay. Great. I will look for it. Paul, thanks for the heads up on that. It sounds fascinating. Thanks for the call. Gary in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Gary.
Good afternoon, sir.
Hi. You wanted to disagree with me about immigration?
Well, I was waiting and listening, I listened to one gentleman talk about the Latin or Hispanic or Spanish workers up at the meatpacking plant getting paid $10 an hour.
Right.
I guess that underscores what I'm wanted to suggest to you and your listeners is that I work in the construction and real estate investment industry out here, and I know of no one, and by that I mean just the laborers, not skilled workers, but just laborers that are getting paid less than $8, $9, $10 an hour.
Yeah,
I don't see any evidence that I'm aware of where people are getting paid less than minimum wage. In fact, they're all getting paid more. So,
well, you've never been out in the agricultural fields. You know, there's an exception actually in our minimum wage laws for that.
But what I was going to suggest is that either an example or a clarification of exactly what you're referring to might be helpful, because, I mean, out here where in the real world where I am, it's just not out here. It's just not true. And so that just concerned me a little bit. I thought it'd be helpful to talk about it.
Gary, you know what we should do? It's been probably a year since we did a show on this, and I believe it's the AFL-CIO that was compiling this stuff. But they, you know, we'll track down the person that we had on. There have been books written about it, about how when you have people who are afraid of the authorities and they're being hired by, you know, by somebody who knows that they have that power over them, they use that power and they abuse that power. It's common sense, and B, there's no shortage of examples of it.
But I have not seen any example of it.
Well, of course not.
In the near recent past.
Of course not.
I think, in fairness, it's not right to claim that that's a prevailing problem, when in fact there's not evidence that it is a prevailing problem. It's to the contrary.
I think
most people, including illegal aliens, are getting paid way more than the minimum wage.
I would submit that you're right. The vast majority are probably being paid more than $7.25 an hour, and the reason I would say that one of the reasons that the meat packing plant is paying $10 an hour now, and they used to pay $13. First of all, just because somebody called up and said it doesn't make it true. Secondly, if it used to be a unionized meat packing plant 20 years ago, it would be in today's dollars the equivalent of maybe $20 an hour that they were probably making. And it to some extent, what you can track is that as industries started hiring people who felt vulnerable, those industries started de-unionizing because the employees knew that if they stood up and spoke out as union members or as if they were union members, that the employer could just squash them like a bug by calling ICE. And so as a consequence of that deunionization of that entire industry, and the two big industries that pretty much everybody knows have been deunionized as a consequence of people who are not legal citizens being hired in large numbers in those industries, are construction and meatpacking. What you see is that the average wage has collapsed. It may not have collapsed down to $3 an hour, although I would submit to you that that is happening in parts of the United States. They're probably more the exception than the rule. But it is happening, and it's a dimension of the fact that these people basically do not have the ability to call on government to defend their rights as workers. Is that a middle ground argument, Gary, that you would accept?
I would respectfully disagree. That's an exceptionally way to the wrong side of the pendulum argument for two reasons. Number one, it's factually incorrect to say that construction workers are getting underpaid. Construction workers where there's work are getting paid way more than the minimum wage.
I'm not starting from the premise that the minimum wage is a reasonable wage.
Number one,
apparently you are.
Well, I'm not. I think the minimum wage is one of the big problems that ironically that's hurting.
Well, there's no evidence of that. Every time the minimum wage, if it was inflation adjusted in 1968, would be $10 an hour right now. And
I can give you evidence of it. I can give you evidence of it. Look at your unemployment rate in with kids, especially in African American youth. These kids that don't have the privilege of better education, that have difficulty getting a job at the minimum wage rate, the sole reason they have difficulty getting a job is because they don't have the skills and education yet that make it worthwhile for employers to pay them.
No, that's not true. You've got, if you're talking about minority communities, you're still endemic racism in the United States. And B, with the deindustrialization in the United States as a consequence of so-called global, international free trade since the Reagan era, has just decimated the ability of people with a high school education or in the neighborhood of a high school education, with a 10th grade education or with a year or two of college, that the people in that range to get a decent job. I mean, we used to, 35% of our workforce used to be in the industrial sector, in the manufacturing sector. Now it's 11%. And countries really start to struggle when manufacturing goes below 15%. This is basic economics. It's what Adam Smith pointed out in Wealth of Nations, that the wealth of nations is the product of manufacturing. It's the application. The example he used was the application of a knife to a tree limb to turn it into an axe handle by the application of human labor and intellect. And the minimum wage has nothing to do with that. What has happened is that as millions and millions of jobs have been sent from the United States overseas as a consequence of a change in our tax policies, also known as our trade policies, the labor market has loosened to the point where, you know, wages are really low, and this hits minority communities hardest and first, because they're the weakest and most fragile of the communities. Gary, you know, I respectfully disagree with you. Thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. It's time, but that, you know, that's kind of a digression from the immigration debate, although we really should have both.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need a national industrial policy, and we need a rational immigration policy, which includes prosecution of illegal employers. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the world. Her report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, a lot going on in the world. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start at the Supreme Court, because they went crazy with rulings today.
Yeah. Well, actually, you can truncate that somewhat, because Shano, who is your and our Supreme Court reporter, is going to be my guest in 12 minutes, 15 minutes.
Okay.
So he's going to go through all that.
I won't do it then, because that's fantastic that he's going to do that, because they ruled on 5 cases, so he's going to have his work cut out for him.
Yeah.
But there's some fun ones. Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, did a live Q&A today with The Guardian and said some interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
He said some sexy things that some people are reporting about, like, why did you tell Glenn Greenwald your salary was $200,000 a year? But he also said, which basically he said that was because at one point it was. That was the high point of his salary. Mm-hmm. But he also said some things that I think were important. He talked about the, gotta pull this up. He talked about whether he sitting at his desk was able to get into stuff. And he also talked about content. He said Americans' communications are collected and viewed on a daily basis on the certification of an analyst rather than a warrant. They excuse this as incidental collection. But at the end of the day, someone at the NSA still has the content of your communications. And he explained that content of emails includes all of it: IPs, raw data, content, headers, attachments, everything. And it gets saved for a very long time.
Right. And not only does the NSA have it, but also your local internet service provider has it, and different ones have different numbers of months that they keep it. It seems like the average seems to be around 25 to 30 months, but different. So it's all over the place. It's amazing.
Right.
Be careful
right.
what you do online.
Be careful what you do online, and obviously don't post that picture to Facebook.
Yes, or don't say anything. And I don't think anybody can say that they've followed this rule, but don't say anything you wouldn't in email that you wouldn't want to see on the front page of the New York Times.
No. The head of the National Security Agency, Keith Alexander, is asking Congress for another authority, which is probably going to tick people off. He wants legal immunity for companies that help the NSA and other agencies fight cyber attackers. He apparently has been petitioning Capitol Hill for months to give internet service providers and other firms new cover from lawsuits when they rely on government data to thwart emerging cyber threats. This is basically so that what he said to a Senate committee on Wednesday was, if the government asks a company to do something to protect the networks or to do something and a mistake is made, and it was our fault, then they should have liability protection for that.
Hmm.
So, of course, the concern among civil libertarians is basically the Center for Democracy and Technology is saying, I think any authorization to enlist companies in related activities is going to have a lot of people up in arms, given the recent revelations about the NSA surveillance activities that seem to go well beyond its statutory authorities.
Right.
So that's a concern.
Yes.
Also, the G8 summit is going on in Northern Ireland. There has been a what is being described as a tense meeting between President Obama and President Putin of Russia. Only finished very recently. We don't know the content yet, although we can be quite sure that Syria would have been discussed very high on the agenda. And I would imagine that President Putin at some point would have mentioned the revelation in yesterday's Guardian that President Obama had spied on President Medvedev at the G20 summit in 2009.
Right. I'm curious. We had a caller who called in and said basically that, in his opinion, that Syria was to Russia what Israel was to the United States. In other words, there was it kind of stands on its face. Do you think that there's anything to that?
I think that Syria is interesting to Russia. I think if you look at a map, Syria is quite close to Russia.
Right. It's an important strategic ally.
It's important strategically. Russia also has a lot of Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to Russia from that point of view also.
Right.
So I think the relationship with Syria is extremely complicated.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think the relationship is similar to the relationship between the United States and Israel.
Okay.
Not at all.
All right.
I think the United States' relationship with Israel is an emotional one.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think the Russian relationship with Syria is emotional at all.
Yeah, it's more tactical and strategic. And
yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I think so. The big story coming out of the G8 was that U.S. and European leaders launched trade talks today aimed at forming a massive $5 trillion transatlantic trading zone.
Oh, my.
Yeah, they say it's going to be an avenue toward creating jobs and boosting economic growth.
In the poorest countries and lowest, cheapest labor countries they can find, yeah.
Well, that's not what they said.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's not what they said,
yeah.
But I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a new Pew poll out today says Americans overwhelmingly oppose arming anti-government groups in Syria. 70% of Americans don't want the U.S. and allies to send arms and military supplies to factions challenging Bashar al-Assad. Only 20% support that strategy.
Wow. Wow. Any thoughts yet, very quickly, on which way President Obama's going to go?
I think he's going to go through with it.
Yeah. Well, he said he's going to, so I guess he's got to do something. Anyway.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsforyogood.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. By the way, to the caller who called in earlier and said undocumented workers are never exploited, and I don't know of any examples of that, and can you demonstrate any? I would suggest you go over to talkingpointsmemo.com and just read the article headlined Report, 7-Eleven Running Plantation System of Undocumented Workers. So, anyhow, that said, Shane O'Farnan is with us. He is a producer of this program. He's also a law school graduate and the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. And Shane, welcome.
How you doing, Tom?
It's weird to say welcome when you're in the theater.
When I've been here for 2 hours
already. Yeah, you sit here every day. But anyhow, welcome to On the Air with me. And you were at the Supreme Court this morning.
Yes, yes. The Supreme Court has a lot of work to do in the next 2 weeks because their term ends next week. And they had, before this morning, had 19 cases to get to.
Mm-hmm.
They got through 5 of them today, leaving 14 for, they have this Thursday and next Monday right now on the schedule. They'll probably add a few more days, but 5 big cases today. Well, 2 big cases and 3 less big cases, unless mm-hmm. you're a litigant in those. Mm-hmm.
So let's go through them.
Sure.
The one that gets a lot of headlines is is they knocked down Arizona's voter suppression law.
Yeah, back in 2004, Arizona had a Proposition 200 that passed that was there to combat voter fraud that's pretty much non-existent, requiring voters to present proof of citizenship when they register.
Right.
So instead of just swearing under oath, which federal law requires, they had to present extra evidence, and if they didn't present this evidence, their registration was getting rejected. The Supreme Court looked at this and said, well, no, there's this federal law, the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, and under that we have this Election Assistance Commission, and they decide what the form says, and you must use and accept this form, State of Arizona, when registering people to vote.
And by the way, all the form basically says is that you must, in order to demonstrate that you're eligible to vote, you must swear to that. You don't have to show a driver's license.
Nothing.
You don't have to, but you have to swear under oath that you are a citizen of the United States
under penalty of perjury.
Under penalty of perjury, which is in Arizona, what, 5 years in the clink?
I think it's three. I looked it up. It's interesting that perjury is a much more severe penalty than voter fraud.
Interesting.
So if they're trying to use the criminal law to prevent voter fraud, they actually made it less teeth in the new law.
Right.
But essentially what they're trying to do with this law is instead of a prosecutor having to prove that you committed voter fraud, you have to prove that you're a citizen. It shifts that burden of proof.
This is how they knock. This is how they didn't knock 33,000 people out the voters' rolls. They prevented 33,000 people from registering, in effect, from voting.
Right, because in 2006, the Supreme Court kind of said you could do this.
Yeah.
And then they went back and reviewed it again. Today they struck it down, saying that the federal form is enough. And it was interesting that Scalia delivered the opinion of the court in his bench statement. Half of it was dedicated to, well, this is the way the law is. In Arizona, if you really want to do this, here's the steps to take. So he went on to say, Arizona, you can go to the Election Assistance Commission. You can ask them to include this in the form, which they had done before. And the commission said, no, you can't do this. But they just went through with it anyways. And he said, then after you get that determination, then you go appeal it, and then appeal it, and appeal it, and then we'll take a look at it later, essentially.
Was he saying that in the context, in your opinion, of here's how you can reconfigure your appeal to us so that we will allow you to have voter suppression laws?
Yeah, he's just saying use the correct process.
Huh.
Because under it is right now, this was a really narrow, you have to use this form because the federal law preempted your rule.
Right. So basically he was just ruling on what the law is as passed by Congress.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It was a 7-2 decision.
Yeah.
So, pretty wide one. Another case that was really, I found a lot of interest in, I know you're interested in intellectual property, patent law.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have, I think you talked with Victoria about this when this case was argued. Pharmaceutical companies that have a patent on a drug, sometimes there's the generics that come out,
right,
and they compete. One thing that goes on in this situation is when the generics come out and they say, we're going to compete with you, we don't violate your patent, there's a lawsuit that ensues. And when they're suing each other over this patent, what happens in a lot of cases is that they'll just settle before they reach the merits of the patent,
sure,
and they collude. Essentially, the person who owns the patent says, I'll pay you tens of millions of dollars over the next, in this case, 9 years,
mm-hmm,
to not compete with me.
Right.
So what happens is you have a market for a drug where there could be competition, the prices could be lowered, but what they do is they just share the monopolistic profits.
Right.
So the FTC brought a lawsuit against, the FTC versus with Solvay Pharmaceuticals, and they were in agreements with Actavis and a couple other pharmaceutical generic companies.
Right.
They had this collusion. They were sharing monopolistic profits. The lower courts had said, FTC, you haven't brought forward a true antitrust case because the patent was never litigated. The Supreme Court said, no, FTC, you can go forward with this. So, it was just one step, one hurdle towards prosecuting this, but the Federal Trade Commission can go after pharmaceutical companies that collude this way.
Yeah. So, in other words, the FTC can enforce competition.
Right.
Government can prevent big corporations from diminishing competition.
Yeah. And the thing was is that they just can bring the case. We don't know how it's going to turn out. They just sent it back and said, okay, now let's go into the facts of it in the lower courts, litigate whether or not this is anti-competitive, what the punishments are, et cetera.
Right.
So another case, Mariach v. Spears. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. It's a name that I've never been able to get right. This is a case in which a bunch of trial lawyers in South Carolina ask the DMV for lists of names and addresses and all kinds of information. And South Carolina turned this over to the trial attorneys. And the attorneys wanted to use this information to solicit new clients in a case they're bringing against car dealerships. And these individuals whose personal information had been revealed by the DMV brought a lawsuit saying it violated what's called the Driver Privacy Protection Act of 1994, which generally prohibits states from disclosing personal information. Because when you go to apply for a driver's license, you give the DMV all kinds of information, sometimes even medical information, you know, seizures, you know, eyesight, right. Your name, address, what cars you're driving, et cetera.
Social Security number.
Those things are protected by this federal act. But there are some subsections, some exceptions to this. The trial lawyer said, well, this is exception 4B, that we were getting this information in connection with, this is the legal language, a judicial and administrative proceeding, including investigation, anticipation of a litigation.
Okay.
The court said no. Now, solicitation is a completely different thing. That's a business transaction. You're not acting as a lawyer. You're acting as a hustler.
Yeah. These were law firms that were looking for people to engage in a class action suit.
Right, against the car dealerships. Yeah. And they said the DMV, you can't do this. Yeah. Another one. This is really interesting. It's a criminal case. Eileen versus United States. A couple guys robbed a store owner together, aided and abetted, and one of the guys had a gun. The guy who didn't have a gun was also convicted, and he was convicted of aiding and abetting and participating in a robbery that involved the use of a gun.
Which is a higher penalty than one that doesn't involve the use of a gun.
Well, actually, using a gun is 5 years. Brandishing a gun is 7. By the way, wait 1 minute. So the jury found that he used a gun, but it was never no evidence was put forward about the brandishing of the gun, okay, which is 7 as opposed to 5. The judge, after he had been convicted by the jury when sentencing, went on to hear evidence and decided that, yes, his cohort did brandish this gun, therefore he gets 7 years.
Right.
Supreme Court said this violates the Sixth Amendment because if it increases the amount of time, that brandishing is an element of the crime and it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt before the jury. The judge can't just decide it.
Right. The Sixth Amendment is you have a right to a jury.
Right to a jury trial of your peers.
Speedy trial.
And all criminal proceedings.
Yeah, no, wait a minute. Seventh is speedy trial.
Seventh is civil trial.
Okay.
Seventh is you over $50, you're entitled to a jury trial for civil matters. So, but, yeah. And there's one more case, but we're not going to have a chance to get to it. It had to do with...
Six shell casing.
Oh, yeah. This had to do with whether or not... if you were silent, if that is admissible against you.
Oh, yeah. This guy was asked, you know, basically, is this your gun? Were these your bullets?
Yeah.
He didn't answer. And they used it against him.
And
the court
said
you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
He should have said, I ain't talking. I'm invoking my Miranda rights.
Exactly.
Amazing. Shane O'Farnham, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So now you all know all about what happened in the Supreme Court today. We'll be back with more of the news of the day. My thoughts, your comments, right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Five before your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to an earlier question you asked early in the show about what our response should be about the revelations of the NSA's spying and phone record gathering program. Mm-hmm. And also, I'd like to go back to something John Dean said, first of all. I strongly disagree with John Dean's assertion that we have nothing to fear at this point, because, after all, what we have is we have at least 112 million or perhaps more Americans. They're having both their Fourth Amendment and privacy rights violated. They're innocent of nothing other than being customers of different phone companies. And I think that we should therefore thank Ed Snowden for revealing this program. And also, I think that we should be worried a little bit more about this phone record gathering program in particular, because I know what the president says and what a lot of politicians in Washington, D.C. are saying is, oh, we have nothing to worry about because they're not actually listening in. But here's the thing, as I was saying to Danielle, I'll give you at least two examples I gave her of how we could learn a lot just by looking at phone records. For instance, if we look at somebody's phone records and we see that they call gay bars a lot, and this person is a gay person in the closet, perhaps we can make inferences about whether or not they are in the closet and gay, because here they have all these calls they've made to gay bars. And also, if somebody calls your radio talk show, which is progressive, and then also we see in their phone records that they've called the Brady campaign to stop handgun violence, we can pretty much determine that they're both liberal and opposed, and they support gun control as opposed to being opposed to gun control. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of examples like that you can give. If somebody calls to AAA, you think, well, maybe they have a problem with alcoholism. Or if you see phone calls made to mental health centers, maybe they have psychological problems. Mm-hmm. And so we can do political or behavioral profiles of people based on their phone records. And I think and this is just a slippery slope. We have to be strongly opposed to this. And I'd like to ask you, if you find it as troubling as I do, that we have so many Democratic and Republican politicians in Washington, D.C., who seem to agree on virtually nothing else, but they can come together and agree with respect to this NSA program, that's perfectly okay for the government to violate so many good, decent, innocent Americans.
You know, the NSA did a briefing on Friday. Members of Congress are saying, we want to know what's going on. We want all the details. Friday, they did a briefing at 1:30 last Friday here in Washington, D.C. 47 senators out of 100 showed up. The rest of them had all left town because, you know, they had things to do, people to see, places to go. It was a day off for them. So, Jerry, I think your points are well made and excellent examples. Jesse in Unity, Maine. Hey, Jesse, you want to talk about Syria?
I'm a big liberal like you, and I've always, you know, been one of those people that were, you know, really against the going into Iraq. My dad was, like, the first person who ever, like, really challenged the possibility that maybe Bush was lying or something. But with Syria, it is so, like, I mean, it's like we, you know, antagonize them to rebel. And now that they're rebelling, it's like, it's almost like we're saying, oh, sorry, we've reached the limit of how many Middle Eastern countries we're willing to help.
Yeah, Bush Sr. did that with Iraq back in the early 80s when, you know, he went on television and encouraged an Iraqi uprising. And in the south of Iraq, I think it was around Basra, as I recall, there was an uprising, and Saddam Hussein came in and killed, what was it, 300,000 people? Some incredible number of people, and buried them in a mass grave, and Bush did nothing. I don't disagree that you know, we have been encouraging the rebels, and you know, I don't think that that's a good policy, frankly. I think that what we should be saying is to any country in the world is, you know, if you are a functioning democratic republic, that, you know, we will be supportive of you in certain ways, but, you know, but we're not going to help you get there. You know, you've got to do that on your own.
If you can't
do it on your own, you're not going to be able to hang on to it.
Yeah, I definitely, and I get what you're saying on that. My fear is that because Turkey's kind of, like, with all the riots that's going on in Turkey right now, I'm afraid that because neither side is, you know, weak enough to lose, and neither side is, like, strong enough to win, so it's almost like this war in Syria is just going to go on and on and on, and I'm afraid it's going to turn into this, like, pulling in other nations and create this regional...
Well, it already has.
War between all these different...
It already has. Factions. It already has, and there's already proxy fighting going on, and Hezbollah is involved now, and Iran is involved now, and Russia's already sent in, you know, surface-to-air missiles and whatnot, and now the U.S. is talking about a no-fly zone, which would put us into direct conflict with Russia. And, you know, the whole thing, it just seems to me like a horrible mess. And, you know, we're all flipped out about the fact that something like 80 or 90,000 Syrians have been killed in the last year or so in this conflict. That's a fraction, a tiny fraction, of the number of people who have been killed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But I don't hear anybody talking about that. It's a fraction of the number of people who have died in Zimbabwe. I don't hear anybody talking about that. It's I mean, look at what's going on in the conflict between South and North Sudan right now and in Darfur. It's still, I mean, you know, Bashir is still killing people in Darfur, and nobody's talking about that. Well, none of those places have oil. And Syria, and a lot of Syria's problems, frankly, date back to the fact that they hit their own peak oil. Syria was an oil exporter. They hit their own peak oil back in the 90s. And so as their oil supplies have declined, their economy has declined, and you know, Bashir has been having more and more problems with that. And then you've got these major, you know, major nation states like Russia and Iran and Qatar and others that are, you know, want to use Syria as a land base to run a pipeline through. And it just gets all very, 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 very complicated. Thanks a lot for the call, Jesse.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It was Henry Kissinger who had promised way back in the day to run a pipeline across Syria for to get oil to Israel. The good, the bad, and the very, very totipalmatally ugly. Brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain, edisonfactor.com. The good, Al Gore. In an interview published this weekend in The Guardian, the former vice president took the Obama administration to task, urging the president to veto the Keystone XL pipeline extension and take action against global climate change before it's too late. He said, "This whole project, the Keystone XL, is an atrocity, but it is even more important for him to regulate carbon dioxide emissions," end quote. Gore added that President Obama should use his executive powers to push through stronger climate regulations, arguing that, quote, "he doesn't need Congress to do anything. If it hurts the feelings of people in the carbon-polluting industries, that's too bad," end quote. Well said, Mr. Vice President. If the Supreme Court hadn't stolen the 2000 election for George W. Bush, you might have been able to make those decisions for yourself and the country a long time ago, and that would have been a really good thing. The bad. Congressman Louis Gohmert. What a surprise, huh? The Texas congressman blasted the FBI during a speech on the House floor on Friday, accusing that agency of working too closely with Islamic groups that he says are a fifth column for implementing Sharia law. Check this out.
"This administration changed the policy, and they had to get friendly and reach out and partner, as the FBI said it originally did, with CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations. The evidence shows that CARE, the Islamic Society of North America, those are front organizations for the Muslim Brotherhood. They want Sharia law to be the law of the land, not our Constitution."
Those groups Congressman Gohmert is so worried about, the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Islamic Society of North America, they have nothing to do with either the Muslim Brotherhood or the takeover of American democracy. They were mistakenly listed as co-conspirators in a terrorism funding scheme by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2008, but that designation has since been removed by that same court. As usual, Congressman Gohmert is just engaging in scare tactics. And the very, very ugly, Monica Crowley. During a Friday guest appearance hosting on the O'Reilly Factor, the Fox host referred to food stamps and other entitlements as narcotics. Check this out.
"No entitlements are narcotics. Do you think there's a political motive here with the far left, which now controls the White House and most of Congress, that they are actively trying to lock people into this government dependency in order to lock in a permanent Democrat voting majority?"
Right, Monica, because helping underprivileged kids buy school lunches is just like dealing heroin. Leave it to Fox so-called news to make helping poor families get healthy nutrition sound like an evil communist plot. That is just very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Okay, I got to share this story with you, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. This is from written by Catherine Thompson. It's on TPM Livewire, talkingpointsmemo.com. And Catherine Thompson writes, this is, and she's reporting basically on an ABC report. I could just easily, I suppose, quote you the ABC report. But Federal officials on Monday seized 7-Eleven franchisees in New York and Virginia as part of an investigation into a ring of undocumented workers who were allegedly forced to work slave hours in a, quote, modern-day plantation system, end quote, ABC News reported. Nine individuals, including store owners and managers from ten New York franchises and four Virginia franchises, were charged with, quote, conspiring to commit wire fraud, stealing identities, and harboring undocumented immigrants, according to federal prosecutor Loretta E. Lynch. And basically what they were doing is they had these people, they were illegal, they were providing them apparently with housing, certainly with employment, but under conditions described by the prosecutors as a modern-day plantation system. This is, you know, 2 hours ago we had a caller call in saying, there's nobody in the country who's suffering because they're not here legally. They're all making more than minimum wage. No. Sorry. It's just, you know, it's, like I said, it's not, they don't walk around with a sign around their necks, right, saying, hey, I'm only making $5 an hour, or I got screwed by my employer, or I'm an undocumented worker here, and therefore. But it is happening in this country, and it's one of the reasons why we need comprehensive immigration reform. Mike in San Martin, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
I think a lot of people misjudge immigrants that come to the U.S. And I think one of the reasons why is the misinformation given to the public. And for me, it's ironic that the Republican Party is against the reform of the immigration legislature when many of their supporters, a big industry, hire immigrants to do labor. I'm a Mexican-American myself. I lived in Mexico for over 25 years, and I worked in the U.S. Selling goods, and our, I could say, target were, you know, immigrants that needed a certain work clothes, and they couldn't have accessibility to these, so we would sell them a merchandise. But they go through so much turmoil, but they wouldn't be coming to the U.S. if it weren't for big corporations, especially in the food industry, like Tyson, you know, poultry industry, the beef industry, pork. They hire these people, they give them jobs, and when they see themselves in jeopardy of being exposed, they find means to give them temporary permits and whatnot. But just speaking to a person in Alabama from Tyson Industry, he mentioned to us, he was not illegal, but he was a worker for Tyson, said this corporation would not exist if it hadn't been for immigrants. The town was literally dead in the 60s and 70s until they found a group of immigrants that they were given jobs, and from there more and more people began working for this industry. Now, this is only one case, the Tyson industry, but it happens in so many other industries, the pork industries. Friedman is another one. I was speaking to some gentleman there in Texas. So it shouldn't be the immigrants that we're pointing fingers at. Like my old man used to say, you look at one finger being pointed and the other ones are pointing back at yourself. We should be blaming big industry for, you know, providing jobs that other people simply do not want.
At least at those wages.
At least at those wages.
Right.
And besides, you know, we've seen some films of what immigrants go through just to reach the U.S. But what a lot of people don't know is what happens to them inside the U.S.
Right.
Being illegal, they're exposed to theft because they, well, I think now they can deposit their money. Wells Fargo, I believe, was one of the first banks that accepted the money deposits from immigrants. But before, they had to carry their money around in their pockets. Thieves knew this, and they were constantly being subject to theft and beatings. I mean, that is just one single scenario that these people go through.
Well, and for women who are illegally here in the who are undocumented immigrants in the United States, rape is a constant problem and a horrible problem because you know, they're afraid to report their rapists, abuse, spousal abuse, you know, stalkers. Now, all those things that citizens just take for granted. That, I mean, these are very real cultural and societal problems among citizens. But, you know, put it on steroids if you have no authority to whom you can appeal.
Well, so I think people would be amazed if they knew how many immigrants have vanished, just disappeared in the U.S. after having worked for who knows who on some faraway farm. They're never seen again. Yeah. Thousands and thousands of immigrants, hardworking, laboring people. My mom's a Mexican, father's American. The only reason they come to the country is to work their butts off and to provide to their families. And we should be thankful that we're getting that fresh lettuce on the table,
yeah.
The chicken, the poultry, the beef. They literally do work from dawn to dusk and then have to deal with other issues, as we just spoke about. So
yeah.
I really commend immigrants. There's a satirical movie made by Sergio Arau. It's called A Day Without Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
Satirical, but in a sense, so true. What would we do without immigrants in this country? it's funny, but it's a sad scenario, and I recommend the movie.
Yeah, and by virtue of the fact that, these folks are not just immigrants. They are immigrants who do not have the legal status to work here. They can be exploited. If they were merely immigrants with legal status, they could not be exploited. They could not be easily robbed and raped. And in the case of the 7-Eleven story in New York and Virginia, made to work as slaves. It would not be possible. And it's a humanitarian reason, if nothing else, for immigration reform. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for your thoughtful comments and sharing your personal stories with us. I appreciate it. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
ABC News reports that the 7-Eleven employees forced to work 100 hours a week while paying rent to their employers to live in boarding houses. So what the 7-Eleven franchisees did is they brought in, or they found, undocumented workers, 18 of them specifically. In this case, they were Pakistanis. They gave them a place to live and charged them rent for it, and then required them to work 100 hours a week in what the federal prosecutors are calling basically plantation conditions. It's like slave wages. It's amazing. 7-Eleven corporate. Is that, keep in mind, 7-Eleven is a franchise, so the individual stores are owned by people other than 7-Eleven, the giant corporation. They just license basically the name and the brand. And so 7-Eleven is aware of today's activity and has been cooperating with federal authorities during their investigation, said Margaret Chabras, Director of Corporate Communications for 7-Eleven, to ABC News. And she said, we'll have no further comment until we learn more. So, pretty amazing. Jim in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Jim, what's up?
I had a thought about Louis Gohmert, Tom.
Okay.
He and Michelle Bachmann say pretty much the same things.
Right.
I have never seen them together at the same time.
Uh-oh.
Is it possible that Michelle is Louis in drag?
Or vice versa.
Could be.
Yeah. I don't know. Faking that accent would be awful tough. Louis Gohmert has an accent that is the closest thing to Gomert Pyle I have heard since I was a kid. And
yeah, but his voice has that nasal quality that Michelle's has.
Yeah, well, there is that.
I think it's close.
Yeah, there is that. Okay.
Anyway, it was just an idle thought. Wanted to share it.
Thank you, Jim. Much appreciated. Thanks for listening to KTNF. George in Los Angeles. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? Fellow Michigander originally from Birmingham.
Oh, great.
Yeah, thank you. Tom, my parents were born in Syria. I was born in Beirut, Lebanon, and we're not Arabs and we're not Muslims. We're Christian Armenians, which is a minority in Syria.
Yes.
And the minorities in Syria are still largely in favor of the Assad regime. They're pro-Assad. It's not because they think he's a good egg. They know he's not. They know his father wasn't. But it's really for self-preservation because the Alawi minority, which Assad belongs to, they're a Shia minority, and that minority running Syria favors all of the other minorities, or at least gives them right.
Well, and in addition to that, I mean, the same thing was...
They can own businesses, yeah.
Yeah, in addition to that, the same thing was the case in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And, you know, he protected Christians and Jews because basically he, like Assad, is running a secular state rather than a religious state, is running a non-religious government. And so they're just, you know, basically, I mean, they're equal opportunity torturers when they want to go after somebody they don't like, but they're also equal opportunity protectors in terms of religion, because the state is not all about religion. And if the Syrian government falls, the secular government of Assad, as terrible as it may be, falls, probably you're going to end up with a religious government. And then those minorities are going to be at risk, as has happened in Iraq in a big way.
Well, they're already having foreign fighters coming in from the Turkish border, Afghans and Tunisians who are fighting with the rebels. So when I hear guys like John McCain talk about Syria like it's just black hats and white hats, he doesn't get it. It really is, if I can borrow a term, 50 shades of gray in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Syria is not simple. It's not a monolith, and there's no cohesive opposition to Assad. They all have their agendas. And when you see Afghans and Tunisians crossing the border from Turkey, that's because Turkey's allowing them, and because Turkey is Sunni and probably wouldn't mind seeing regime change in Syria.
Jerry in Woodbury, thank you for the call. Jerry in Woodbury, New Jersey. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for all you do. I just wanted to let your audience know I'm a union electrician out of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I've been out of work, one of 600 out of work, for the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm presently driving a truck over the road non-union, and I've owned my own electrical contracting business. I have my New Jersey contractor's license. Very difficult test to pass. And I just wanted to let everybody know that the best my family has lived is when I was working as a union electrician. I am still a member, but there's just no work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have three small children. You know, I'm away from them all week, but I'm driving the truck over the road because that's what I know how to do.
Right.
But I had a pension plan, a vacation fund, health care. And when I got laid off as an electrician, we signed our kids up for New Jersey Family Care to cover them for health care.
Wow.
The next month, Governor Christie said that anybody that's on unemployment cannot go on New Jersey Family Care. We just made the cut to cover our kids.
Chris Christie said that if you are on unemployment, you don't qualify for basically Medicare?
It's New Jersey. It's their own health care for children and families.
Right, but it's funded by Medicare. Every state brands it with their own name, but it's basically Medicare.
Yes. Right, yes. If you are on unemployment, you cannot go on. The next month he did that.
Wow.
The next month. We just
compassionate conservatism.
Yeah, and you know how I was alert to that? Was from listening to progressive radio. That's what alerted me to sign them up.
Yeah.
You know, and I owning my own contracting business, the best I live is when I'm working union. And I know plenty of hardworking people. And I wanted to leave you with one point. Of all the construction trades, can you take a guess at how many monthly pension checks they collect, the national average, before they die?
No.
13.
Huh. Amazing. That's not a lot. Jerry, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Spot on. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news, of course, and information on the evolving NSA domestic surveillance scandal. Plus, what would happen if we stopped regulating businesses? I'll confront conservative Brian Tracy, who thinks government should just back off when it comes to business. Yeah, right. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag your it. Occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.